You never know when somebody's going to walk in here with a cardboard box with a cat in it. It happens like at least
Yes,
two
of
or three
course.
times a week.
And if you say, okay, we are an animal sanctuary or we're an animal clinic, then
Things
yeah.
arrive. Yeah.
Hello and welcome to the Mackerel Podcast. I'm Carolyn Wee. This is part two of our three-part conversation with three people on three very different islands. One of the things that motivated me to produce this series of chats is sunshine. Yes, sunshine. For all intents and purposes, Singapore is an island, a tropical island. It might not look like one anymore, and it certainly doesn't smell like one, but it is. What ought to be a salty sea breeze has become more a mix of vehicle exhaust and fried rice. The thing about islands is there ought to be sunshine. Lots of it. We have predictable sunsets in Singapore. No seasons, no drastic changes in temperature. It's either hot or very hot. Wet or very wet. Although these days, climate change has given rise to periods of very dry weather here. But still, sunshine is guaranteed. Even so, a National Population Health Survey revealed that approximately 40% of Singaporeans are vitamin D deficient. How? I also don't know. Well, actually, I think I do know. We don't get enough sunshine for so many stupid reasons. Too many of us are indoors most of the time. Because it's too hot outside. And if we aren't indoors, we're under some shade or umbrella. Or in long sleeves like the Invisible Man, because we don't want our skin to burn. Less to do with melanoma than not wanting to look like a dark-skinned person. Whoa, 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 whoa. That's a whole other discussion that needs to happen, just not right now. My immediate point is this. I'm on an island, but I have to go chasing sunshine to ensure that I get my daily dose of vitamin D. Quite aside from physical well-being, being outside does wonders for emotional and mental well-being too. Just as structure does wonders for a person's state of mental health. Having a reason to get out of bed every morning isn't just routine. It's necessary. The science is out there for the reading, so please go ahead and explore this in more detail. But for now, we're going with the anecdotal experience. I'm speaking with Ashley Sanderson, a biomechanics instructor who focuses on horse riders. Ashley is on Gili Trawangan in Indonesia, and she explains the importance of creating structure in her day to stave off vacuity. In all honesty, though, Ashley might have cheated on this one. She's had a lot of help from a kitten named Batty. And the cool thing is, Batty holds the secret to eternal life.
Ashley, please do us a favor and tell us a little bit about yourself and, more important, how you got stranded on Gili Trawangan in the first place.
It's a good place to be stranded, I'll tell you that. I am a freelance biomechanics instructor. So I travel around the world teaching people, mainly horse riders, how to improve their riding and their relationship with their horses by looking at themselves, their balance, their body, how they hold themselves, and work with them, their thoughts, their riding their horses, how ethical they feel about how they ride, and trying to help both the riders and the horses have a better understanding. So I spend 2 or 3 months at a time in Asia and then in Africa and then in Europe. And I was doing my Asia stint when we started to get locked down. So I managed to get myself to friends here on Gili Trawangan, supposedly for a week or two. And it's now been 2 months and 2 weeks that I've been sitting here.
And I'm
still waiting.
Primarily to go diving, right?
I came to come diving, and also my friend runs a charity called Horses of Gili, who I support, and I always bring them donated tack and equipment and medical supplies. So I arrived to bring them some supplies, go diving, see the horses, and I got stuck. And I've been sitting here ever since.
Wow. Okay. And it's like, I think it's now for everyone who's stuck anywhere in the world, we're looking at about 2 months and counting, if not more, right?
Uh-huh.
So maybe, and I think this is the burning question that I have, and I have this for anybody who's isolated anywhere. How do you stop yourself from going completely and utterly mad?
I think there's two things involved in this. One is you have to have some form of schedule or structure, because if your days are just endless, then it creates more of a problem.
Right.
So here, because I'm based at a dive center here, but she also runs the cat hospital and the horse hospital. So every morning, everyone has a job to do. They're either feeding and checking horses, feeding and checking cats, feeding the goats, feeding the parrots, checking on the gig, doing something. So you can't lie in bed. Everyone is up doing, going. Every morning I go to the stables. I treat some of the horses that needed medication. I check on everyone. Then you've got a few hours in the middle of the day, and then evening time it's back to feeding animals, checking animals, getting them ready to go to bed for the night.
Right.
And I think that's a huge part of it.
I've read a lot of news articles and watched countless dodo videos, obviously, because I am a fan of the dodo. And they have this program called Foster Diaries, and it's essentially that. It's people in this period of isolation and lockdown looking after animals, because A, the animals need it. B is, I think, people need it as well, just as you say.
Yeah. It's really easy just to lie in bed and not do anything, unless there's a cat tapping you on the face saying that they want breakfast.
Right, exactly. But presumably, it didn't immediately become like that, right, Ashley? Come on, I mean, did you feel in the first couple of weeks that you were like, what, I'm stuck? What, huh? Hello? No, I cannot be stuck. I've got places to go. I have people to teach.
I did, absolutely, because I am on a flight at least once a week. And I'm on a long haul flight at least once every 6 weeks. I haven't sat still for 2.5 months in about 6 years. So it was really, really claustrophobic initially, that I have to move. I have to go and do something. I have to get out. And it took about a month before I went, okay, I'm here. There's nothing I can do about it. So just get on with it, really.
Right. Surrendering, it's that acknowledgement that this is what you have to work with.
Yeah. I was chatting to a friend a couple of days ago, and her life is very structured. On Monday she has lunch with her mom, on Tuesday she has coffee with her work group, on Wednesday she does this, on Thursday she does this. And I think the fact that I have no normal routine has actually helped me, because I'm not sitting here thinking, oh, today's the day I should be meeting this person. Today's the day I should be having my riding lesson. For me, days mean nothing. So I think it helps me, the fact that I'm not thinking about what I'm missing out on.
Ah, so it's a little bit like an attachment to a routine. And if that is suddenly taken away from you, then you would feel even more awful about it. I mean, because as it is already, you're like, I can't even get to Lombok.
Yeah.
So, you know, let alone go for lunch with a friend.
I can see Lombok. I'm sitting here looking at Lombok and I can't get there. So we really are stuck on our little island.
Just out of curiosity, if you swam from Giliti to Lombok, how long would it take?
Oh, I think people paddleboard it in about 20 minutes. There's a lot of current, so it's not an easy little swim or paddleboard. But by boat, it's 5 minutes. It's really close.
Have you felt desperate enough to try to swim across to Lombok?
I'm tempted. There is a temptation that it could happen.
Just get me out of here!
it could be very tempted. Put a scuba dive tank on and just go under the waves and you'll be there in minutes.
Right, because you can see it. And it's like,
yeah.
And
just there.
And even now, given the situation, even though things seem to be improving around the world, I think the latest is that Bali is only going to open itself to tourism again in October.
That's what that
So,
looks like.
what the prospect for you then is, what exactly do you think?
Well, at the moment, the Indonesian governments have said they're opening airports on the 1st of June, but the local council who controls Lombok and the three Gili Islands has said they're not opening up anything until we've all been tested. So at the moment, it's a waiting game. They told us initially not to expect anything until mid-July. They closed everything down because they didn't want people traveling too much through Ramadan. So we're looking to see, we've had Idul Fitri, Ramadan is over. They're looking to see if there's another infection spike in 2 weeks' time. And they're saying wait until July and we will reevaluate and see what happens. So it really is a waiting game that we don't know month by month when they're going to decide to let us travel.
How are you getting over that anxiety of this waiting game? Though I imagine there is some anxiety.
There's still a little element of claustrophobia because I don't sit still. So for me to be here is a challenge. I'm trying to take some of my work online, so I'm looking at doing webinars and things. But also, I can lose myself in books and in webinars and that kind of thing. So I'm spending quite a lot of time trying to develop my skills, reading, thinking about different things. There's a few interesting people on the island who I can have good discussions with. So I'm trying to keep myself mentally working, challenged, awake to distract myself from being stuck. And at least here we can swim, we can cycle around the island. We are social distancing. We're not sitting in groups, but we're not stuck in an apartment. We can move around.
This is true, and I think that actually makes a huge difference, because if I compare it to a situation that I'm in, for example, not me personally, but yeah, technically I'm on an island, right? But hey, when did Singapore stop looking like an actual island? And there are lots of people, like you say, stuck in an apartment and more worryingly alone. So they don't even have an animal to look after. And yes, under those circumstances, I suppose a structure, as you say, is important, but and also keeping mentally alive. Speaking of mentally alive, I cannot help but I need to talk about Batty. We need to introduce Batty to the world.
My Batty Catty.
Yes, your Batty Catty. Could you please tell listeners who Batty is?
When I had been here about 3 or 4 days, I went to the local little supermarket, and there on the step was this tiny little kitten lying on a towel, looking very sick and sad and sorry for herself. I don't speak very much Indonesian at all, and the shopkeeper doesn't speak very much English at all.
Helpful, always
But
helpful, yes.
it's always helpful. But in our very broken language, she was saying the ibu, the mother, was dead, and she was bottle feeding the kitten milk out of the fridge. And I really didn't think this kitten was going to live more than a few more hours because she was very weak and wasn't really responsive. So I asked the shop owner if I could take her, and everybody knows my friend here who runs the horse hospital. So I asked her if I could take her, which she said, yes, carry on. And there's no motorized vehicles here, so I was on my bicycle. So I pick up this kitten, put her in my pocket, cycled home with her,
You put
expecting
her in a
her to
plaster.
live for a couple of hours. I thought, well, at least she won't die here on her own. Got her back here. My friend Tori said she's really sick. She's probably going to die. And I said, yes, I know. But we'd look after her until either she died or we had to put her down. And I've now had her for 2.5 months,
Oh my
and
gosh.
she's got bigger and stronger and naughtier day by day. But when I first walked in with this little black creature with enormous ears and enormous eyes, the first thing everybody said was, "Have you got a bat? Are you holding a bat in your hand?" Yes. And so when she started to look like she was surviving, and they all kept saying she needs a name, and I said, "Well, she's the Bat Cat, because what else are you going to call her?" So my little Bat Cat has become a celebrity. Everybody, "Where's the Bat Cat? How is she today? What is she doing?" And she's become a real icon for everyone.
Well, that's the thing. She's become a symbol of survival. And I mean, how's this for empowerment and positive self-image, okay? Because I have seen pictures of Betty, and she is not pretty. She is in no way attractive. If I were to be really, really shallow, and I'd say, she's, because first of all, she's they're kind of like a tortoise shell, right? She's mottled.
Yes. She's mottled black and ginger, yeah.
Yes. And then she's got these giant eyes and giant ears that are too big for her head.
Yes, and long spider legs that are really
very
out of proportion.
Very long spider, spindly legs, and a very huge tummy. So can you imagine? That's just looking a little bit alien-like already, right? but my gosh, she's pulled through. Thanks to you, she's pulled through.
She's got a real survivor, fighter spirit. She's not going to lie down and die for anyone.
So I'm just wondering, my gosh, is she this giant metaphor for something else here? Because we are going through this global pandemic, and then here you have this little Bat Cat who's teaching us all a lesson or two. I mean, what do you reckon? What do you get out of that?
I think she is. I think she absolutely has come to show us that you can survive anything. And also how she's always looking for entertainment. She's always looking for, what can I do now? What can I chase? Who can I go and annoy a little bit? What am I going to do? She'll do naughty things and she'll look at you while she's doing them. And I think she's just always looking for a game and looking for fun, which I think a lot of us have forgotten about.
Right. Yeah. And she's had conversations with cockroaches. And
she has long conversations with cockroaches.
And so therefore she has the secret to eternal life.
she killed, there was a cockroach who was living in our bathroom, and I called him Roy. And Bat killed Roy the roach.
Oh no.
Bat killed Roy the roach. And I said to my friend, "We're in trouble now, because roaches live through anything. And the fact that now Roy is dead, we're in trouble." And she said, no, Bat interrogated him. Bat now knows the secret of everything. So that's it. We're okay. As long as Bat's okay, she knows how to survive the Holocaust. We're fine.
Oh, my God. So I think we can all look at this positively and say that we will pull through this like cockroaches.
We will get through this because Bat knows the secret of life. We're okay.
Well, speaking of which, the only way of, I think, actually pulling out of this is actually taking this seriously, right?
And
fully aware of why we need social distancing. And I mean, you say that you're still able to go for a swim, go for a cycle around the island with social distancing. So, and I know, we've also talked about this, and you read the news, and then there's this COVIDiots, right? There's a new term, COVIDiots, and these are the people who walk around without a mask and don't care about social distancing because they're immune, blah 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 blah. How would you say people on Giliti how seriously are they taking this pandemic?
Initially, it was almost a little bit frightening because there were military boats going around the island. The island is tiny. It's something like 3 kilometers by 5 kilometers. It's a little island. Mm. And there were military boats patrolling around, making sure that there were no boats coming in and out. And there were immigration and police on the island now that we've all been stuck here for 2 months, people are a little more relaxed because we've been in isolation on the island for all this time. But they still, we're not allowed to have groups of more than 3 or 4 people. If the police come past and there are 10 people sitting at a bar, they will close it down. So here at the dive center where I am, I think there's about 8 of us foreigners who are trapped here and about 15 staff. So within the dive center, yes, we all sit and have dinner together, but it's because we now are considered a household. Yeah. But as soon as we leave the dive center, everyone's being very careful. Everyone's keeping distances apart, not going into each other's houses, wearing masks if you're going shopping or anywhere into town. So people are aware and being careful and not getting close.
Have there been any infections on the island?
We're not sure. A few of us have had flu-like symptoms. And initially we thought maybe it was dengue, but with dengue you always get a rash, which none of us have. So we don't know. None of us have had any breathing issues, but we have had flu with fevers and other symptoms. We know that there are cases on Lombok. So if anyone is sick, they are isolating, staying in their room for a few weeks and being careful. So everyone is very aware and watching out and making sure that we don't take any stupid risks. Even at sunset.
How many people are there on the island?
There's about 300 in total, of which 100 are either foreigners, tourists who are trapped like me, or foreign business owners, and about 200 local Lombok
residents.
Indonesians.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And you were saying even at sunset? What about that? Yeah. Sorry, I cut you off.
Our part of the island is great for watching sunset, and so you will see people coming and gathering to see the sunset. But you'll see 2 or 3 people standing, and each pair or group will be 5-10 meters away from the other. So that's really interesting watching. There'll be maybe 20 people watching sunset, but they won't be sitting together watching sunset. They'll all be separated down the beach.
What sort of feeling does that give you?
It's slightly strange. It's the whole thing is quite surreal that we're all in it together, but within that we're all separated and going on our own journey through it. So it's a really surreal feel. Mm. One of my favorite movies ever was called City of Angels. It had Nicolas Cage in it, where he's an angel and they're on Earth but they're separated. And one of the scenes is that all these angels arrive at the beach at sunrise and sunset, and they're there watching, but they're separate from it. And it often reminds me of that scene.
Right.
That we're all here, but we're not really together here.
Right. It's a shared experience broadly speaking, a shared experience, but there's something very private about it at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah.
In those private moments, what do you think about?
I think for me, I'm always busy. I'm always hectic. I'm always running. Even if I am currently teaching here in this place, part of my brain and planning is 2 cities further down my list, a month ahead of my time. So for me, actually being present and being in one place, almost like my brain and my body are in one place and being still, that for me is always a challenge. And that, I suppose, is mindfulness. Just sitting quietly, watching the sunset, listening to the waves, often Batcat is with me. Oh. And actually being present is a really nice thing, but it's, for a long time, it was a very challenging thing.
Was it difficult to get into?
Yes. And it always has been for me difficult to actually be fully present in wherever I am.
Was it scary?
Yeah, I think in the beginning, certainly it was, because then you start to really think about things and not about well, yes, I remember that email and that person, and I must call that person and have they got the diary sorted. So it is, you start to think more about the experience and what you're noticing and what's happening in the current situation. So it is scary.
I would imagine that sitting quietly is difficult for many, many people. In fact, I would say it's difficult for most people, because it's really easy to just get caught up in the, oh, I got to do this and I got to do that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then it's a nice feeling of being busy, right?
Being being useful.
Yeah. And so that's the thing. It's, can you not be useful being still? I don't know. You know, must there be a very tangible product at the end of the day before one could be considered useful?
Useful.
Oh, right? You know, the whole malarkey about like productivity.
We must be busy.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And so the output becomes so important. But then what we forget is that there's a lot of input that needs to go in as well. It's like that well, right? You got to fill the well before you can do anything with it. And
Yep. I read a book a long time ago called Simple Pushes, where Simple Pushes. And his first question is, if you're driving a car, do you push the steering wheel or do you pull the steering wheel? And he says certain activities are pulling and certain are pushing.
Yeah, exactly. So, it depends on whether or not you want to go faster or whether you want to slow down. Right?
Yeah.
And you think that action on the steering wheel is going to make a difference.
Going to make a difference. But he says, you know, reading is pulling. You're gathering information in, whereas writing is pushing. Learning is pulling. Teaching is writing. Cooking, feeding people is
pushing,
but eating is pulling. And he thinks there's going to be a balance, because if you're always pushing or always pulling, you'll be out of balance. I guess being busy, teaching, traveling, being useful, it's all the time it's pushing. And this is very much a time for pulling. It's sitting, it's reading, it's thinking, it's being still, it's noticing.
And at some point, when the time is ready, you are going to have to be pushing again, which you will be.
Yeah.
So,
which I think we're luckier here, because you can't be still and outside and quiet as much in Singapore, even though it's still an island.
You kidding me? Yeah, no, not at all. You almost have to create that environment for yourself. You have to create it. You have to be very aware of literally scheduling it in.
Yes.
Even now you have to schedule it in, because we have all these other like things that are being pushed at us. You know, Zoom fatigue much? I don't know.
Yes.
Every other bloody thing is on Zoom. This webinar, this talk, this minute, this team meeting, blah, 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 blah. And you're like, no, you know what? I really don't want to Zoom anymore. I'm very sick and tired of Zooming. it's very irritating. And actually, but this is an observation I made. But we're talking about islands, right? So, like, Michelle's on a beautiful island in the Philippines. You're on a beautiful island in Indonesia, and I'm on an island, lah. Okay,
you're on an island.
I'm on an island, supposedly, and it's like you would imagine that because I'm on an island, I should be able to just step outside and get some sunshine, no?
Yes.
Because that's what an island is. But no, and there are statistics, and I was looking up the statistics from Ministry of Health and everything else, that about 40% of Singaporeans actually suffer from a vitamin D deficiency. And you wonder how. Why?
Yes.
Hey, you're supposed to be able to, it's sunshine all year round. You know, you just step outside and get some sunshine. You could step outside of your villa and get some sunshine. Michelle steps out of her villa and she gets sunshine immediately, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
But here, I have to go chasing sunshine.
And we're not that far apart geographically.
No, we're not. We're not. But we are absolutely worlds apart.
Yes.
Which brings me to my next question. What is your recommendation that people do during isolation? What could they do?
For me, I read a huge amount, and reading is, I can get lost in a book, but I don't like fluffy fiction. My isolation book so far has been called Every 12 Seconds.
Oh, please tell us about it.
It took me quite a bit of courage to start reading it. A while ago, I was reading online, and they were talking about the 50 most influential books about politics and humans and how we work for the past 20 years. And one of their top recommendations was this book called Every 12 Seconds. And a political journalist went undercover in an American slaughterhouse. And he
worked. I'm not liking it already. I'm very scared.
Initially, I was like, no, I can't read that. He worked there for 5 months in the liver line, the kill line, and quality control.
And the liver line?
The liver line. He stands in a little concrete room underneath a conveyor belt of hooks, and fresh livers come to him, and he has 12 seconds to unhook a liver and put it on a cart that goes to the chiller.
Oh, God.
And that's what he does for 10 hours a day, is work with 3,500 fresh livers for 10 hours a day in a little concrete room. It's actually been the most amazing book, and it has really held my attention. His whole argument is that we hide brutal things in plain sight. Mm. And a lot of the meat industry call a slaughterhouse a harvesting plant because they're harvesting product. And within the plant, it's all divided into little concrete rooms, so that no one actually sees the whole process.
The entirety of the slaughter.
Yeah. So where he was handling livers. And further down the line, somebody is handling the intestine or whatever part of the cow. And there are 121 workers in the plant where he is. And a lot of it is the conversations that he's having. So at one point, he has a conversation with someone who is in the meat packing department, and he tells them that he wants to learn to be the guy he's called the knocker. He's the one who initially stuns the cow. And this person is the knocker because he knocks the captive bolt into the cow's head.
Oh, God, yeah.
And the person he's talking to said, no, you don't want to be the knocker because he's the person responsible for killing the cow. And this, the author, Tim, said, but there's 121 of us here, we're all responsible for killing the cow. And even within those 121 people, as far as they're concerned, only one person is actually responsible for the whole process, and it's the guy that initially stuns the cow. And the whole book is about how easily governments, politicians, anyone hides things that are unpleasant by we don't eat a dead cow, we eat beef. We don't eat a steer, we eat a little piece of produce, which is steak, that has come wrapped in plastic and in a supermarket. How many people won't read the book because they don't want to know where their food comes from, because that's nasty and dirty and unpleasant, and we don't want to be associated with it.
Of course so not. It's, because you literally don't want to get blood on your hands.
Yes, literally. And how it used to be that the hunter who came home with the dead bison was the hero, but now we don't want to know about it, see it, be involved in it. And how, yes, they're killing cows. They kill 3,500 cattle a day. But how, in his opinion, they're also killing those 121 people because they're kept in isolation. They are kept in the dark. They are told that they're part of the family and they want loyalty. There's no press allowed. There's no outsiders allowed. And it's a lot of people who are not educated, who can't read or write, who are working there, and they have been working there forever because they're locked into the system.
Right.
It's a very, very clever book, and it's a very interesting book, but it has been quite hard going at times.
How long did you take to read it? I mean, surely it's not one of those things that you can read cover to cover. You've got to dip in and out. And anytime you dip in and out, yeah. the stomach for it, right?
Yeah. Initially, I read it really slowly because a lot of it was about the laws around slaughterhouses, how difficult they are to get in and out of. So initially, it was like a page a day. Now it's much more conversations, well, towards the end, much more conversations. So it's taken a good 6 weeks to actually get through the whole book. But it's been a real eye-opener. A lot of it is not about killing cows. A lot of it is about politics and how it affects people.
Yes, exactly. We have to look at the wider message here. As you describe it, the workers at the slaughterhouse, they are marginalized, essentially, right? I mean, if they're so isolated, and also they are the uneducated. So it means that it's this exploitation that's going on there as well.
And, yes.
The first thing that came to mind when you first mentioned it was PTSD. Surely there is a shitload of PTSD that's going on there.
Yeah.
With the workers.
Well, the person he talked to in the meat packing area said, you don't want to be the one who kills the cows because they have to go and see psychologists because it does affect them mentally. And one of the chapters where he talks about, he's in the cattle corralling chutes where they're pushing the cattle into the kill floor. And one of the other workers says, it's fine, you can push the cow because what we're selling here is violence and cruelty. But later on, that same worker sees a distressed cow, and he's the first to leave because he's saying, I don't want to deal with a cow that's in this distressed situation. So I think there's got to be PTSD and denial that they're not actually there killing cows because they're in a different part of the plant.
Well, and also it's the knocker that kills the cow.
It's the knocker that kills the cow. It's not the other 120 people there.
Yikes. Wow.
And he later talks about war and says, you know, your country goes to war and you're saying, yes, we should go to war. We should fight for the cause. And on the news, they talk about collateral damage. 10 people were killed today in collateral damage. They don't talk about how your soldiers were killed because that's unpleasant. But if you talk about collateral damage, the words themselves distance you from what's really going on.
Right. Yeah. It dehumanizes the people involved.
Yeah.
Just as it I don't know what would you say sensitizes the animals involved in that sense.
Yeah.
Robs them of their sentience.
Very, very quickly they get the hides off and take away any personality that the cow had. It just becomes a side of beef. It does. It's not a cow anymore. So very, very few people at the plant see it as a cow. Most of them see it as a product.
A product, it remains from there right up until the time it's loaded onto a supermarket shelf.
Yeah. It takes 45 minutes for the cow to go from standing and live to being in a plastic bag.
Wow. Okay. This conversation's taken a very grim turn, but I think it's a very important, it's a very important grim turn. So, and also in some sense, I've grown tired of conversations around the coronavirus. It's like, oh, I don't know. Yes, it's a shared experience. Yes, the middle.
Mm-hmm.
But if we look at the bigger picture, it's kind of like, okay, and as a result, you find yourself with more time in your hands. What are you going to do with that time?
Yes.
Right? So I think educating yourself is probably a good way of spending that time.
Yeah. I think reading, talking, you know, like I said, there's some really interesting people here. So you can have some good conversations about people from different cultures, different languages. It's good to keep asking questions.
So because you, Ashley, are an extremely interesting person, and I don't say this just because I've been your friend of more than 10 years. I do think that you do some crazy things. And how would people find you? Where can they go to find out a little bit more about you?
I'm on a lot of the social media. So Instagram, I have a website, Facebook pages. My business name is Kodaguru, which translates into horse teacher, which actually the Malaysian staff called me when I used to work in Malaysia 10 years ago.
Right. Again, so just for the benefit of everyone, that's
Kudaguru. Yeah.
All lowercase, all one word. And that's your Instagram handle, right?
Yes.
Okay. Then Facebook, same thing, right? They can just look for you on Facebook using that name, Kudaguru.
Same thing, yes. And also there's a website, which is the same thing, kudaguru.com.
Okay, there you go. And because you were saying that one of the things you have been working on also is some online lessons. So what have you managed to come up with in your time in isolation on the island?
I teach a lot of something called longlining, which is working with horses on the end of two ropes, empowering horses, giving them back that they control their position of their body, how they're working, which I've done for many years, but for a long time I resisted teaching it because I didn't know how to, basically. And then for the past year or so, I have been teaching longlining in workshops. So a big chunk of my time has been translating that into an online course, which has just gone live a couple of weeks ago. And I'm working on another course on proprioception, spatial awareness, reading horses' body language, how we should be asking the horses questions. A big thing of what I'm always telling pupils, the most important instructor you have is the four-legged instructor who you're sitting on, because he has no ego, he has no agenda, he has no reason for saying, that's amazing, you're so good at doing what you're doing. And so a lot of instructors are like, yes, that's amazing, you're so good. And so it's reading what a horse is telling you, because they are talking to you all the time. So that's the next course that I'm trying to
teach. If you're sat on them the wrong way, or if you're kicking them a little bit too hard, they can tell you.
Yes. And a lot of people are saying, the stupid horse won't turn right. And I'm saying to them, actually, if I could ask the horse would be saying, this rider is so blocked to the right, I can't turn. And so it's working out the horse's perceptions of what the rider is doing and how the horse is trying to tell you what's working and what isn't working.
Yeah, and you know what? It looks like you have a few more months to continue working.
I have
on
a long
it.
Time to keep writing.
Yes, you know, you just might decide to swim across to Lombok. I don't know.
You never know.
And maybe not stay on Lombok, but just for the hell of it, swim across the Lombok, touch the shore, and then swim back.
Swim back.
Then I'll take that cat with me. Yeah, put a life jacket on her, and then you'll be fine. Off you go, right?
Yeah, I'm sure she would be up for the challenge.
Definitely. Look, she has the secret to eternal life, right?
So she does.
She's definitely somebody we need to learn from. But Ashley, thank you very much. Thank you very much for telling us what life on Gili Trawangan has been like, and also for giving us a little bit more insight to ourselves.
Well, thank you for being a distraction for the morning.
I think I do that best. That's what I do.
Thanks very much for listening. Stay plugged in for our third conversation in this series, which features sunshiny Singapore as lived through the experiences of artist Yen Pang and the Mackerel team, poet Mark Naya and me, Carolyn Wee. If you'd like to get in touch, please write us an email, hello@mackerel.life. Bye for now, and stay healthy.